The Noes Have It in Colombia, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Colombians reject the peace deal between their government and leftist rebels. Seems some voters can't let go after 5 decades of conflict.
The collective trauma is still there, but they chose vengeance over forgiveness.
Plus, Marco Werman heads to the Mexican border. Local ranchers there are fighting illegal immigration and drug smuggling. Marco asks one if he's ever thought of leaving and gets this response.
Maybe you should leave. Everybody thinks it's my problem. It's your problem because they're coming to your neighborhood. And you ought to get down on your knees and kiss my feet for staying here and slowing it down a little bit.
Those stories ahead on The World. We've got a packed show for you today. Later, we'll be heading out to Arizona, where Marco Werman has been reporting on life along the U.S.-Mexico border. He'll take over for the second half of the show from the studios of KJZZ in Phoenix. But we begin today with the shocking result from this weekend's referendum in Colombia. It was a simple yes or no question to approve or reject a peace deal between the government and leftist rebels. The yes vote was expected to win easily, officially ending 52 years of war. Instead, voters rejected the peace pact, with a narrow majority of 50.2% voting no.
I feel a bit, devastated, to be honest with you.
Colombian-American reporter Luis Gallo voted yes in the referendum. He's in Bogota and says it's pretty surreal there today.
Everybody's disoriented. As the results were coming in, I was here with my family, some who voted yes, some who voted no. Everybody was just looking at each other in shock. We didn't know what it actually meant. I immediately wanted to go out and report and interview people. And the first reaction from my family was like, no, you can't leave because we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there might be bombings. We're back at war. So in a sense, it was that type of feeling that oh my God, what have we done? Like what is happening? Like what is going to happen? And that was a question everybody was asking each other. What happens now?
So Luis, you're saying Colombia feels dangerous again already?
I think as soon as the votes came in, it felt that way. Because there was a moment about an hour and a half till the last report came that 99% of the votes were counted and the no had won by 56,000 votes until the president spoke. So there was like that gap of time that we didn't know what was going to happen or what it meant, what the no meant. Because first of all, the president didn't have a plan B. And he admitted that. He was convinced that the yes was going to win. Even the opposition, the no side, it had no speech of winning, no victory speech. So there was a moment of like a media blackout with government. Government wasn't responding because everybody was scrambling to come up with something to say. It was that big of a shock that even the government was, unable to come up with something. And once the president spoke, and he said that he had spoken to FARC, to the leaders, and then saying that the ceasefire agreement still, held. So that gave Colombians a lot of, it gave us like a little bit of relief that, okay, we're not back at war. We're not going to see bombings in downtown Bogota, and then after following the president, the FARC leader, Rodrigo Londoño, he also spoke and he said he's committed to the peace talks. He wants to, continue negotiating and that the ceasefire was still in place. So that calmed a lot of Colombians. Like that gave us some relief.
But it leaves a lot of uncertainty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So just to back up a bit, your own father was killed by the FARC when you were a child, and yet you were really sure you wanted this. You wanted peace and reconciliation.
Correct. Yeah. I was 100% sure I wanted a new chapter in Colombian history. I was ready to, to come to terms with, the FARC killing my father and me forgiving them. In a sense, I made peace with it, and I think a lot of other victims, they also made peace with the fact that, their families disappeared or they were displaced or, and looking at how Colombia voted regionally, the areas affected by the conflict the most they were the ones who voted for yes the most.
But your mother was not ready to forgive. She was going to vote no. She did vote no, yeah?
Yeah, she wasn't ready to forgive, exactly. And other people in my family weren't either. And, you know, I mean, that speaks, you know, very loudly that Colombia is still not healed. That there's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of sense of injustice with the peace accord. So in a sense, I feel like, yes, 50% of the people are willing to forgive, to move on, to build a new country. And 50% of the rest of the country isn't. You know, the other 50% wants a harsher punishment to the FARC. You know, the collective trauma is still there. You know, the collective trauma is still felt by so many other Colombians that they chose, you know, vengeance over forgiveness.
Reporter Luis Gallo in Bogota, thank you.
Thank you.
There was another referendum taking place this weekend in Hungary. Voters there were asked to approve or reject European Union quotas requiring countries to accept a minimum number of refugees. The Hungarian government is against the EU quotas and put the issue to a popular vote. Yesterday, more than 98% of Hungarians who voted backed the government's anti-immigrant stance. But the result is meaningless because the referendum required 50% turnout to be declared valid, and only 40% of eligible voters showed up. But the result still shows how big the immigration issue is in Hungary. Reporter Andrew Connolly is in the capital, Budapest.
Hungary is a small country of 10 million people. It's predominantly white, it's predominantly Christian, and it's predominantly monocultural. Hungary doesn't have a history of mass immigration. In fact, one of the problems it has is that it's a net exporter of their own migrants. There is a large brain drain. It's also to do with the ruling party, who ironically started out as a liberal, radical student, anti-communist movement, but in recent times has reverted into quite a right-wing, some would even say far-right party, who does whip up xenophobic sentiments to try and shore up their base and also to distract away from some allegations of corruption, economic mismanagement, and a mass centralization of power.
So Hungary does not sound like a happy place right now politically, and it also sounds as if it could well be said to be trying to wrestle with its future. What is Hungary? Who is Hungary?
Sure. I think it's also in the context of quite a divided European Union at the moment. There is a common theme of sovereignty, which was also very much a part of the referendum too. I mean, it wasn't so much that all Hungarians hate migrants and refugees. It's not so simple as that. It's also kind of a territorial issue. Hungary did used to be a larger territory. It lost some of its territory after treaties in World War I. Hungary has not really had independence for a very long time. It's been occupied by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Nazis, the Soviet Union. So the government is using the European Union in quite a sort of a bogeyman way to say this is the latest kind of occupying power telling us what to do and telling us who we should live with, which is quite ironic again because Hungary is one of the largest recipients of EU funds. So it is biting the hand that feeds it.
Andrew, what's it like to report there? I mean, the images you describe are pretty striking in the sort of level of xenophobic rhetoric.
Well, I've been covering the refugee crisis in Europe for over a year now, and I was quite regularly in Hungary in 2015, and in the capital Budapest, you saw thousands upon thousands of desperate refugee families in the train stations, in the parks. It was really quite a horrific scene, and at the time I interviewed the spokesman for the Prime Minister. And I asked him if he would, you know, if his government would provide any support for these people. Some of them are, you know, in need of medical attention. And he said, no, we won't do that because they shouldn't be here. So there was, from the very beginning, a complete refusal to engage with a humanitarian crisis on its territory. Luckily enough, though, many, many Hungarians did rise to the occasion and come out and volunteer, treat the wounded, clothe the children. There was a mass outpouring of volunteerism and compassion, which Hungary civil society hadn't seen in quite a while.
Reporter Andrew Connolly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So what is up with all the referendums lately? We just heard about the ones in Hungary and Colombia this weekend. There was also the Brexit vote last June. I asked Matt Vortrup why so many politicians are putting issues up for a popular vote rather than just deciding them for themselves. Vortrup is a professor at Coventry University in England and editor of the book Referendums Around the World.
The first politician who used them at the national level was Napoleon, who held a number of referendums after he had taken power in France to make sure that the people actually agreed with his policies.
He's not the only kind of big man dictator type to do that, right? What is the history of strong men and referendums?
General Pinochet used referendums a lot. He was forced out by a referendum in the end. Mussolini has held referendums, and Hitler has held referendums. So it's sort of a list of people that are not particularly savory. However, one should say in the defense of the referendum that they also held elections, and both referendums and elections in dictatorships are, of course, notoriously unfair.
So if we set that aside, why historically have politicians turned to referendums?
I think politicians generally turn to referendums when they chicken a little bit, which is not perhaps very nice to say to them. But we often have referendums in times of upheaval, when the kaleidoscope has not quite sort of settled, if you like. So after the First World War, we had referendums. We've had them a lot of referendums after the fall of communism. So typically we have referendums when politicians are a little bit unsure of what the people think. And therefore, it's sort of like a safe way of kicking it out to the people.
Why do you think we're seeing so many referendums right now?
I think we, in a way, it's probably quite simple. I think we used to live in the age of the package deal, and we would go with things that were sort of selected for us. Now we've become much more individual. People who live in Colorado might consider themselves Republican, but they may also think that it's reasonable that you can have access to marijuana or you can have gay marriage, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're not a good conservative. So you can be fiscally conservative but socially liberal. The referendum allows you for that. In a way, it is a sign of an individualized society, and it's also a sign of the political parties not representing everybody in the way they used to represent them before.
There was talk after Brexit that people had voted yes because they didn't think it would pass. And I spoke to a journalist in Colombia this morning who also felt that some people voted no, but they assumed it was going to pass. Is that a danger of referendums?
I think it's a danger of most things. I mean, there might be people who voted for political parties thinking that these parties were never going to win, or voted for candidates who they thought were never going to win. So there might be individuals in America who will wake up with a President Clinton or a President Trump and realize that person has now won and they thought it was a joke. So that is true for elections as well as referendums.
So what is the essential difference between elections and referendums?
The difference is that in an election, you're choosing a candidate. It's a trust issue. You put your faith in an individual just the same way as you put your faith in an estate agent or a lawyer or a doctor. A referendum does not do away with the political estate agents, the political lawyers, but it allows you to say to that person, wait a minute, you're not going to sell my house unless I agree to it. Referendums is just a way of making sure that the people are the boss and not the politicians. Now, the problem is that sometimes if you have an estate agent, then you want them to get on with the job and sell your house, and you don't want them to come back to you and say, are you happy with this? Are you happy with this? Sometimes you ask people to do things for you so that you can get on with your life.
Matt Vortrup is a professor of political science at Coventry University and an expert on referendums. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The World. British journalist Gary Young's new book is based on a simple, tragic statistic. Every day, on average, 7 children and teens are shot dead in the US.
Most of these stories don't even really make the local news beyond 500 words, sometimes if that.
So Young picked a day at random, November 23rd, 2013. 10 American children and teens died in gunfire that day. Young set out to learn each of their stories. One of the lives he traced was that of 16-year-old Edwin Rajo of Houston. He was a boisterous, almost silly kid in a rough high school. His mother, Marlene, was born in Honduras. She hid in the driver's cab of an 18-wheeler with eight other people to make her way to the U.S. Marlene speaks almost no English, so Young says it was especially hard for her when she got called in to talk to administrators at Edwin's high school.
Edwin is always in and out of the behavioral office for kind of minor but persistent infractions, really. He just can't settle down. One of the teachers said he wasn't a bad kid, he was just busy. And he's the oldest son, and his mother keeps being called to school, and she would say to him, Edwin, what are you doing to me? You're the oldest, you should be setting an example. And he would promise her, this is not going to happen again. I'm really sorry.
He struggled in a school where these gangs, these black and Latino gangs, had a major presence. Tell us a little bit about Lee High School in Houston and Edwin's life there.
The fact of life in this kind of area of Houston, your relationship to gangs is a bit like people's relationship to the Communist Party in the Soviet Union or the Ba'ath Party in Iraq. Like, if you live in those blocks, you're already gang-related. And Edwin, as far as anybody could tell me, wasn't involved in the gang. He might have wanted to be, but my guess is he'd have been too much of a liability. But I don't even know whether, you know, he really wanted to be. But his friends, some of his friends were in it, and certainly his best friend, Camilla, was involved.
And as you tell us, you write about the high school and the apartment complex and this atmosphere and the gangs, we're almost set up to expect a stereotypical gang death. But that's not quite what happened. Tell us how he died.
He dies in his best friend's bedroom. She has acquired a gun because her brother had been shot at, and there's a guy who's kind of after them and who's talked in social media about coming for them. And so she thinks that it's better that they get one to protect them. And this young woman is like Edwin's protector, and she is involved in the gang. And so they acquire this gun, and she keeps it under her bed. And Edwin comes over one night telling his mum that he's gone with his siblings to see some puppies around the corner. And he goes to her room and they are playing with the gun. And Edwin, who could just be a bit of a ninny at times, says, come on, let's play with the gun. And she takes the clip out and assumes that it's empty, holds it to his chest and pulls the trigger, not realizing there's one in the chamber. And she said to me, I didn't know anything about guns. I only knew that you shot them, that's all. But I thought if the clip was out, that was it. And so there's this moment where time cannot be turned back. And Edwin says, dude, you shot me. And she says, I'm sorry, dude. And then Edwin's eyes roll back and Edwin's, you know, breathing his last.
Mm. No one is punished in the shooting death of Edwin Rajo, and you point out that that, in a way, offered its own reward. Can you read for us the section about that?
Paradoxically, given that there's been no punishment, there has also been more forgiveness. Camilla went to Edwin's funeral. Her Facebook cover photo shows her sitting next to Edwin's grave, all in black, surrounded by flowers and balloons, smoking what looks like a joint. His sister and brother are cool, she says. But every time I'm with them, I know what happened. I feel bad because they don't have a brother no more. The only person I'm not cool with is his mum.
It's interesting that Edwin's mother also, looking back, she didn't wish that she had stayed in Honduras and never come to the States.
No, her feeling was, you know, this could happen anywhere. She didn't blame America for it. And then when I interviewed her, she was heavily pregnant and she had a boy and she called him Edwin.
Gary, you weave personal anecdotes from your own life throughout the book. How did your identity affect the reporting and the writing and whether and how people opened up to you?
Well, in terms of the writing, I mean, you bring yourself into these projects. I'm a small, kind of tubby, disheveled British guy who's black. You know, when people think British journalist, they're not thinking me. generally in my journalistic life here, and I worked in America for 12 years, just only returned to Britain last year, there is a moment of dissonance, you know, where people kind of have to rearrange their expectations. But by and large, people actually really wanted to talk to me. 10 children died that day, were shot dead that day. 7 black, 2 Latino, 1 white. And generally speaking, their deaths get precious little coverage. And so to have someone arrive and say, everything you'd like to tell me about your son, and they were all boys that day, I would like to hear. It gives them a sense that somebody cares, because when they actually were shot dead, it looked for a lot of them like nobody really cared.
Mm. A lot of the reporting was also on social media, and I was struck by the way this sort of culture of teen gun death does play out on Facebook.
Particularly Facebook and Twitter, for some of these kids, they're like online graveyards. Every couple of months, there's another RIP. For teenagers, certainly, surrounded by death in a way that would not be familiar to me beyond a war zone, it was quite incredible.
Gary, American teens are 17 times more likely to die from gun violence than their peers in other high-income countries. Did you know the book before you wrote it, or what
No.
did you come away with?
A few things that I came away with. The first was a realization that the parents of every black child had factored in the possibility that their child might be shot dead. Samuel Brightman's mother in Dallas says, I didn't think it would be him, I thought it would be his brother. Father in Newark says, you wouldn't be doing your job properly if you didn't think that your son could be shot dead as a black father. And then the other thing was the degree to which guns don't come up. If you ask the open-ended question, what do you think this is about? Guns don't come up. And I conclude that for some people in these areas, imagining a world without guns would be like if your child was run over and you try to imagine a world without traffic. And in fact, at least with traffic, if you put up a stop sign or you wanted to put up a speed bump, no one would say it was unconstitutional. And so in the absence of any kind of conversation about guns that they can really seize on and imagine, they turn to other things. When you ask them about gun control specifically, most of them say it's crazy that they're so freely available and it's terrible and so on. But when you ask an open-ended question, guns don't come up. That did surprise me.
And do you think that's peculiarly American?
Well, in no other Western country in the world would this book be possible. I come from Britain, which has a range of problems and in a way has most of the problems that America has in terms of segregation, inequality, poverty, mental health. But the one thing it doesn't have on the top of that pile of tinder is guns.
Gary Young's new book is called Another Day in the Death of America, A Chronicle of 10 Short Lives. Gary, thank you.
Thank you.
You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. I just met a rancher in Arizona who's fed up with immigrants and drug smugglers.
This is supposed to be America. Do I have to leave? So we give them 20 miles of America. Next year, we'll give them another 20 miles.
We're talking border issues from station KJZZ in Phoenix, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. But for the next half hour, we're coming to you from station KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm here with the World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, and the host of our Otherhood podcast, Rupa Shenoy, was also out here in Arizona recently. All three of us reporting from the state's southern border with Mexico about the issues related to the border that keep coming up in this presidential campaign. And there are many: immigration, immigration reform, border security, the wall. So we wanted to come here to try and understand what's at stake for everyone down here in the southwest corner of the U.S., people like ranchers whose livelihood depends on the border, and Border Patrol agents and officials who have to secure it, and the undocumented immigrants who wind up in detention after crossing over from Mexico. We'll be hearing stories about all of them over the next half hour. But first, let me situate you. Think about the state of Arizona. Phoenix, the capital, and the lower third of the state. Southeast of Phoenix, about halfway to the Mexican border, is Tucson. I drove from Tucson to a ranch about 20 miles north of the border. It's barren, but beautiful terrain. At sunset, the ridges off in the distance turn a rusty pink.
Hello.
Hello.
We're looking for the ranch for Ed Ashurst. Is this the road, or is it the next one down? This one. All right.
A Border Patrol officer was parked on the gravel side road to the Ashurst Ranch, just watching the rare car go by, looking out for anything that looks suspicious. Washington has made a sharp increase in funding for the Border Patrol since 2005, and Arizona has about 4,000 of the agency's total 20,000 agents.
My name is Ed Ashurst, lifelong 65-year-old Arizona cowboy.
What do you do here?
Run a big cow outfit.
How many head of cattle?
Oh, about 1,000.
Ed Ashurst wants people to know what's going on in this corner of the country.
Before anything's done on the border, the people who run this country, the president, vice president, Supreme Court, Senate, House, Department of Homeland Security, they need to decide that we actually have a national problem here. And they have not done that.
Living this close to the U.S. southern border, those problems literally hit close to home. One of the more personal events that impacted Ed Ashurst was the death in 2010 of his friend, another rancher by the name of Rob Krentz. It was a well-known case, never solved, but many believed it was a murder committed by someone who had crossed over from Mexico illegally.
Rob was murdered that way about 6 miles, straight down there. He left home early that morning to check some water lines to water cattle with. And at 10 o'clock, he radioed his brother and said he saw an illegal alien that looked like he was injured, and he was going to go down and check him out, ask his brother to call the Border Patrol. They never saw Rob again.
That was probably the most painful border story for Ashurst and many in the small but tight-knit community of ranchers in southeast Arizona. But the stories, as Ed says, are many. He often sees people smuggling nearby.
We used to see 2, 3, 4, 5 bunches a day. I saw one bunch of 600.
His house, out in the middle of nowhere, has been robbed.
8 days ago, there was a deported felon standing right in the door of that building there. He had been deported multiple times, and he had done hard time in a prison in the United States.
Then there's drug smuggling, and the attempts are brazen.
We're talking 1,500 pounds of marijuana on each load.
The smugglers simply use a power hacksaw to cut through the fence and get their contraband through. Ed Ashurst and other ranchers have witnessed it.
We're talking steel fence, 10 places it's 10 foot high, places 13 foot high, and it costs several million dollars a mile, and it's not stopping it.
That's why Ed Ashurst is ambivalent about a longer, higher fence, but he also thinks the U.S. Border Patrol could be doing more. I asked him if that Border Patrol agent I saw at the end of his road gave him any comfort.
Sometimes there's multiple Border Patrol trucks there. The interesting thing, being you notice that, is we're 20 miles north of the border. You go south of here, and there will be no Border Patrol.
We have a big concern here. My citizens do. The ones that live in the rural parts of Cochise County, they're very vulnerable. I don't know how they can say it. Their public safety is very vulnerable.
That's Mark Daniels, the sheriff of Cochise County. And he doesn't get why the Border Patrol sees the border, not as a line to be patrolled, but as a strip of land anywhere from 20 to 30 miles wide where smugglers can move almost undetected.
And then to try to catch them 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 miles away from the border, that's insane to me. If it's, as local law enforcement officer for over 32 years of addressing problems here in Cochise County, if we know we have a drug house, we don't go 10 miles from the drug house. We go to the drug house, and we let them know we're there to address it. I don't understand why there's not more at the border.
He says the fact that the border is seen more as a zone and not a line means that crime has penetrated Cochise County. Sheriff Daniels has responded locally, giving out radios to ranchers so they can reach him faster in emergencies. That's supposed to go fully online next year. And the violence has also gotten personal for Sheriff Daniels.
A couple years ago, my son, who's a police officer here in this town that we're sitting in, a cartel tried to kill him on a traffic stop. He shot and killed one of the members of the cartel. The next day, I get a call to my office, and his police department got a call that they're going to kill me. And so within 48 hours, I had him in my backyard, and my deputies and I chased him off. It's a serious game we play down here.
Do you feel like you've been let down by Washington?
Yes.
If you think about it, it is an existential problem. The border is one of those things that defines a country. Sheriff Daniels and ranchers like Ed Ashurst have spoken with senators and congresspeople about their concerns. But the sheriff and Ashurst don't think Washington politicians see the gravity of the situation the way they do. And that's what frustrates them. They've heard the talk for years and are worried that nothing will really change for them, whoever's in the White House next. I asked Ed Ashurst if any of this would ever make him think about giving up ranching.
Does it give people around here pause to consider that maybe they should leave? I mean, is it getting to that point?
Maybe you should leave. Because that's the thing that you people in Boston don't get. Everybody thinks it's my problem. It's your problem. Because they're coming to your neighborhood. They are already there. And you ought to get down on your knees and kiss my feet for staying here and slowing it down a little bit. I mean, don't, no disrespect intended, but this is supposed to be America. Do I have to leave? So we give them 20 miles of America. Next year, we'll give them another 20 miles.
Rancher Ed Ashurst in southeast Arizona, just north of the U.S.-Mexican border. He wants people to stop coming across the border illegally, but for various reasons, it keeps happening. And those migrants who get apprehended, they often end up being deported. But before deportation, many spend time in detention centers. More than two-thirds of those centers are privately run. The Department of Homeland Security has contracts with several companies that run them. And yesterday, the World's Global Nation editor Monica Campbell went with several families to one detention center in Eloy, Arizona, on their weekly visit to their loved ones. So, Monica, how did your Sunday start?
Early in the morning, 5:45 a.m., I met about 10 people. We climbed into a white van, and we rolled down the freeway about an hour to the Eloy Detention Center. This is something these people do, families do, every Saturday or Sunday, and I was allowed to accompany them.
Right, and the driver has a license, but these other people, they're undocumented, and they don't have licenses, correct?
That's right. So there's a practical reason for this. The driver can go and drive and not worry about being pulled over and getting deported. The van is full of people who don't have papers here in the United States. And then there's also a sense of community. These are families and people who are together going through really difficult times. Every single person in this van represents a family being split by deportation or possible deportation.
So where is Eloy, Arizona's detention center? What does it look like?
Well, it's about an hour outside of Phoenix, Arizona. It's in the middle of the desert, the middle of nowhere. You approach it and it sort of comes up like it looks like a prison. And I sat next to one little boy. He's a seventh grader. And I asked him what it looked like, and he described it this way.
There's a lot of fence with electrical wires, and there's lots of cameras everywhere. And when you get inside, the waiting room is full, and you have to wait a really long time to get in.
Yeah, you have to wait a long time to get in the hot sun, right? How long were you out there?
Well, it's a series of rooms. It's an all-day process to visit somebody inside. First, you wait in line outside in this gated area, kind of like a cage. There's nothing over you. So it was about 96 degrees when we got there. You're out in the sun. There's no shade. At one point, it rained. Nothing to cover you. Then you go inside. There's another waiting room. You get a number. And then you go into another waiting room. And before you actually go inside this kind of large classroom where people sit down and have lunch together.
So who actually runs the Eloy Detention Center?
Corrections Corporation of America, which is a private contractor that DHS contracts out to run many detention centers in the United States. More than half, easily, of the detention centers in the United States are run by these private contractors.
And like any private subcontractor, they've got their own staff of privately hired corrections officers. It must be pretty regimented.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a place where people are inside waiting for their court date. The majority of the people in these detention centers are there for civil offenses. But if you just didn't know any of that and you walked up to this place, you would think, I'm visiting a prison. And that's exactly what it feels like when you go inside. you feel like a prisoner. You feel like you're visiting a prisoner. You take off your shoes. You go in there. You're stripped of everything. I couldn't take anything but my ID. And you can't take food in. It's a very high security situation.
So people would go in for 1 hour visits. You went in with one family. What was that like?
I went in with one family. They invited me to accompany them to have lunch. This is a really important meal. This is their weekly sit-down Sunday meal. And I went in with a family. They were going to visit their father, Miguel, who's spent most of his life in the United States. He's got two kids and his wife. We sat down, and you can't bring food in. So this room is lined with vending machines. So the kids, like everybody, just raids these vending machines. And they're expensive. I mean, think of like a vending machine in an airport. Mm. They're high priced. So everybody gets like chips and sandwiches, and there's a line at the microwave to heat up these kind of dodgy looking sandwiches. But what was extremely touching for me was to see this young boy, Sergio, the one who described the detention center when we were driving up. He opened the bag of Doritos, kind of like made a plate of it. He opened everything and sort of set the table for his father. And it was just extremely touching to see, you know, this is a 1 hour, very particularly special moment for these families. And they make the best of this time together. But it's the kind of food, it's the sort of atmosphere that, you know, nobody would really wish on any Sunday.
Why is Miguel in detention?
Well, he crossed the border illegally twice, and he was also pulled over here in Arizona for a traffic infraction. That's enough to get you in detention. It's not looking good. He doesn't have a lawyer. I mean, he did, but the lawyer didn't work. They spent a lot of money on lawyers, these families, and these are tough cases. And Arizona is a tough place to be detained. A lot of the judges here have a really high rate of rejecting people's claims. He's petitioning for asylum because he's from a part of Mexico where, you know, it's run by narcos. If he goes back there, you know, I bet everything he's going to come right back, not just because his family's here, but because it's a dangerous place to be and there's no work.
Unless you want to work for the cartels.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why he left in the first place.
So you're sitting around this table with this very modest Sunday supper. What are the conversations like? I mean, families who are visiting, dads and sons who might be deported back to their countries.
They don't talk about deportation. They don't talk about what is really hanging over the family, which is the very strong likelihood that everyone in this room having lunch together is probably going to be split up. That's not something anyone wants to talk about.
Yeah.
They want to talk about, you know, soccer practice. How is everyone doing in school? They don't want to talk about how dad's spending his time, you know, apart from this hour. It's depressing. What was striking was to see that at the end of this hour, they looked at each other right until they walked out of the room, you know, and that was the last time that mostly men that I saw in this room were going to see their family for another week.
You saw a lot yesterday, Monica. How did this affect you personally?
It was hard. I report on immigration in the United States full time. I report on Mexico. And when you're sitting in this room and you're seeing people just, you know, in this really kind of bleak environment with vending machines and crappy food, creating this intimate setting, trying to just have some normalcy in their lives, no matter how you think about immigration and what we should do about it in the United States, you can't see this and not think that there's got to be a different way.
The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, thanks very much for sharing this experience with us.
Thanks, Marco.
Whether it's about undocumented immigrants in detention about to be deported, or ranchers who are angry that they still have to deal with a porous border, you can see how complicated the whole border is. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, coming to you from station KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. We're here to speak with people along the U.S.-Mexico border about the issues that are important to them this election season, like immigration and border security. We heard earlier from a rancher and a local county sheriff, and then also from undocumented immigrants waiting to be deported. My colleague Rupa Shenoy has our next story. She hosts our Otherhood podcast, which focuses on people who straddle different identities in America. And here in Arizona, Rupa started out by speaking with a couple of Border Patrol agents who happen to be Latino.
In front of the Tucson Border Patrol compound, there's a big sign that says they're hiring. The parking lot is full, and cars are crammed onto extra lawn space.
Hi.
Hi.
These are Lanes.
It's nice to meet you. I'm Rupa.
I talked to agents Vicente Paco and Daniel Hernandez outside in the courtyard. The two of them visit local high schools and tell students they can get a good job with the Border Patrol here. And this is an area where jobs can be hard to come by. Hernandez says they have to compete with cartels trying to recruit the same teenagers to help smuggle drugs or people north.
So primarily the Hispanic youth that know the border culture that can travel into Mexico and kind of blend in there and travel north into the United States are the ones that are more susceptible.
How do you speak to those kids, but then not make them feel profiled?
Well, the thing is I'm one of those kids.
And Hernandez says he looks like those kids. His parents are Mexican immigrants, and he grew up in an Arizona border town where he saw people who worked with the cartels get killed.
I need more than two hands to count how many friends that in high school were killed. Through a different turn of events, would have maybe ended up the wrong path, you know. But I had good parents, and I understood the risks involved. So is it a profiling? I don't believe so.
Okay, so tell me if I'm wrong, but many people say this, that as the kid of immigrants, you have just like a basic gratitude to be in the United States and to be American because you have so many opportunities and
right.
things like that here. So how do you deal with that when you interact with other people who don't have the same opportunities?
You know, we don't choose where we live. We're here.
This is Agent Paco. His family, like many here, have moved back and forth across the border for generations. Paco was born in Mexico, but inherited American citizenship through his father, a Californian who fought for the U.S. in the Korean War.
To those who are over there, and that might say, oh, you got lucky because, you know, you were brought over here and this and that and another. Well, I don't know.
That's a parallel universe, Paco says. He doesn't like to speculate.
You know, it's hard for me to say they could have, would have, should have, you know. I can only speak of what happened. There are opportunities in other places. They're just different and maybe not as rewarding as there are in the United States. That's why, you know, this is the country where everybody wants to be on and looks up to. You know, I will make sure that my kids understand that.
Paco has to walk a fine line. Some people in his own community just don't like that he's a border guard.
I have family members or friends that I grew up with in the border town where I was raised. And I tell them, you know, it's like, it's another job. You know, it's a job that, you know, I swore to uphold the law. And whatever that law is, I'm going to enforce. And, you know, I will do the job that I'm being paid to do by the American public.
Hernandez kind of echoes Paco.
I'm proud of my country and I'll serve my country. But I do recognize other people's, you know, struggles, perhaps. In other countries, but at the same time, things are the way they are, and I try to do the best in my community, in my world. You know, I try not to think too far out. It's a great country, and everybody wants to come here, but not everybody can. You know, unfortunately, but that's the way things are, and I'm just grateful that I'm an American.
It can be tough when public sentiment turns against border guards, like when the media runs stories about the deaths of migrants trying to cross the desert from Mexico to the United States. Paco and Hernandez say it frustrates and saddens them when people risk their lives and break the law. They say all border agents can do when that happens is focus on the job, which often is to save people they find trying to cross.
Sometimes we're seen as this entity that might be a little stern and harsh to some people, but we're not. You know, we're focused on humanitarian efforts because it's the right thing to do.
From Border Patrol headquarters, it's less than a 10-minute drive to the local medical examiner's office, where Kat Rodriguez says the buildup of Border Patrol agents in southern Arizona didn't happen by chance.
Militarizing the border at the more common crossing places and intentionally pushing the flow of migration into the more isolated, desolate areas was an intentional strategy.
A strategy by the U.S. government that Rodriguez says isn't working because people trying to reach the U.S. aren't deterred by the harsh journey across the desert. Rodriguez is a specialist with the Colibri Center, a nonprofit housed inside the medical examiner's office. It was created to identify the remains of people who die while crossing the unforgiving desert.
This beautiful, amazing, pristine, but utterly cruel and does not discriminate, and it does not forgive you in the winter, and it does not forgive you in the summer, and it will take everything from you.
So much so that it's almost like the desert swallows up the bodies of those who die. Sometimes there are just small pieces of people left, like a fragment of a skull.
You know, we have to sit there on the phone and like, beg families, like, don't open the box when it comes home to you. You know, I mean, that's... Sorry. No. That is probably the thing that makes me the most ashamed, is like, here's what we're sending home to you. And, you know, we straddle this place of the living and the dead because we're looking at a skull on this screen and a picture of this guy at his wedding on another. And you just can't, you know, you just can't, like, sometimes reconcile that that person's not here anymore. Some days it's really hard, you know, and it's just a constant feeling like we are trying to make up for something our government is doing, and it's not enough.
Last month, Rodriguez and her colleagues identified 21 people who died in the desert. She and the border guards, Paco and Hernandez, they're all very aware that the upcoming presidential election has the potential to drastically change the border policy and the situation here in southern Arizona. Hernandez says that's how it should be. That's what he tells people when they try to talk to him about politics.
You know, we tell them, if you don't like the law, then change it. We're the ones that enforce the laws, but we're not the ones that create them.
Power over American border policy, he says, rests with those who've always had it, the American people. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Tucson.
We've tried to capture several sides of the border story today on The World. As you heard, none of this is clear-cut. And it really helped to come from New England, where I'm usually based, down to the Southwest to try and understand how unclear it all is. We'll be learning more tomorrow, by the way, here in Phoenix, as The World and the BBC World Service host a discussion about the border, Arizona and the 2016 vote. Even if you can't make the event here tomorrow, we'll be broadcasting the forum as a special edition of The World this coming Friday. For now, I'm Marco Werman, signing off from KJZZ in Phoenix. Thank you for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.